This is Audible.
Dark Passenger. Written by Donald Alan Kirch. Narrated by Holly Jackson. Chapter 1. Egypt, the Valley of the Kings. March 31st, 1909. The American lowered his binoculars and sighed heavily. He scanned the horizon looking for clues, but couldn't find anything. The heat was playing tricks with his brain, and he wished for miracles. He wished for magic. He believed in what he had been searching for and was determined to find it.
"Master, the work crews are starting on a new dig," a small Arabic man shouted, beckoning the Western gentleman to pay attention. "Please come, please come."
It would seem that magic would have to wait yet another day. Is there a child in the world who does not believe in magic? Magic was at the heart of everything held sacred and noble by the people of ancient Egypt. The blood that pumped through the core of this magic were the muddy waters of the River Nile. To some, she was the heart of Africa, keeping the continent alive with her vibrant life force. To Egypt, she was a god. All life began and ended at her command. To live without the Nile was to live in eternal damnation. Lost. Pharaohs believed in magic. Old king or young, they held the faith. Perhaps it was this very belief that prompted them to travel down her shores to their final place of rest. The Valley of the Kings was a treasure chest to any fool or scholar. If one were lucky enough, smart enough, strong enough, and in some cases stupid enough to venture into her bowels, gold was for the taking. The ancient pharaoh's greatness had been measured by their gold, and they intended to take it with them. One could own the gold if he avoided the risks involved. Egypt was a land of treasure, but she was also a land of curses. Stories traveled like wildfire within the working parties of strange events that defied logic, such as healthy Western men laughing at a long-ignored warning carved in Egyptian script at the foot of some tomb, not to stay healthy for long. Egypt was also a land of death. Dennis Parker had given up a plush office at Oxford for the arid hills of this ancient land that held for him more promise than any academic status. It took 2 years of planning, but through it all, he finally made it. Backing had been shaky. He worked for the French, obtaining extra funds when he could, but most of the money came from his own family fortune. Parker had been the only son of an American railroad tycoon. Although the estate was useful in his pursuits, Parker always doubted that his own father would have approved. Upon first glance at Dennis Parker, the average person would not consider him worthwhile to remember. Parker was typical. Blonde hair, slightly overweight, cursed with a certain clumsiness associated with overexcited people, and cool blue eyes. He had the ability to avoid recognition in a room of equals and still come out satisfied. Some, upon first sight, wondered how he ever survived infancy. Parker, however, was a man of action. Like most men of his character, he used his shortcomings as weapons. Many a time his general appearance and complacent nature saved him from an inspection or jail cell. He was, in spite of his appearance, a force to be reckoned with, never to be misjudged, always loyal to those he called a friend. Parker headed toward his work crew, grabbing his notepad, his clothes sticking to his already soaking body. The sun hadn't even made it midpoint. It was going to be a hot day. Parker groaned, spitting dust out of his mouth. With shovels slicing the dunes, Arabic songs in the air, and the smell of human sweat, 200 men waged a scholarly war with a secret concealed by the many centuries of time. The Valley of the Kings was the ideal place to hide something if one never intended it to be found again. Parker knew this, and if he were to locate the tomb, knowing how important its occupant had been to her kingdom, even though she was considered an evil foe, it would be in this valley. Larceny, more than anything, brought about the valley's creation. It became evident to priest and pharaoh alike that the pyramids and their powers were no match for the greed of the ordinary criminal. So in the early days of the new kingdom, Pharaoh Thutmosis decided that a more challenging resting place should be found to counterbalance the avidity.
"It's here," Parker vowed, studying his maps of the valley. "I know it. Just waiting for me to find."
Parker looked out over the valley. The same challenging resting place that had held him and his men for the past several years, hoping to find what she already knew.
Massive cliffs magnified the rays of the sun as they boiled the hot sands and rock that was below. Inhospitable sand dunes carried with them, as the winds blew, every conceivable sickness one could think of. It was no wonder to Parker, upon first seeing the site, that he had to practically pay double to have natives work there. Western money was a temptation, but so was the power of old superstitions. Superstitions still taken into account, and by some tales, still practiced in remote tents throughout the desert. Parker had his own fears, fears more pressing than some ancient king's curse. Parker was looking for a tomb without permits. In the plain sense of the word, he was breaking the law. Back in college, when Parker was a green student filled with the lust for adventure, nobody bothered to warn him about the bloody paperwork. Sure, get some shovels, head for the hills, and try to dig up some long-lost secret from the past. Sure, it's the find of a lifetime. However, if you don't have the proper papers, it's off to jail, or worse, put up against the wall and shot for grave robbing. 5 years of dust, sand snakes, and waiting. It would have been a shame to return to London, or home to America, empty-handed. Impossible misfortune cursed Parker and his work crew since the day they arrived. However, all that changed when a small boy came across a little 7-inch statuette with the name Ka Ray inscribed upon it. This was a fantastic find. Ka Ray's tomb was what Parker had been looking for. It was the grave of a priestess whose actions so alarmed those around her that her fellow priests tried to eradicate her entire existence from the mind of man. Even in her doom, however, her power demanded that she have a burial fitting a religious leader of her station. Ka Ray, whose name meant the light of death. To understand Ka Ray's crimes, one must understand the ancient Egyptian concept of the human soul. The beliefs of Egypt divided the soul into 5 parts. The Ba, the Ka, the name, the body, and the shadow. It was only in the first 3 of these elements that Ka Ray sought power, and in which she committed her crimes. The Ba was the most important aspect of the soul. In the Ba, one kept all that was good and noble in the human character. Since reincarnation was the desired dream of all Egyptians, one hoped, always, of returning to their Ba. If not, the Ka was steadily available. The Ka was the soul's double, or stand-in. If the body was too corrupted for the return of the soul, one jumped into the man-made double. This tragically did not preserve the Ba. Still, it offered life, where once there was only death. In fact, to return to one's Ka was a saying for returning to one's death. Then there was the name. To us, in modern times, a name is identification, perhaps given to us to honor a past relative. To the ancient Egyptian, the name was one's physical proof of walking upon the earth. If one's name were blotted out or never spoken, it was like erasing oneself from the face of mankind. Everyone, from peasant to pharaoh, did their best to preserve their name, always to have it spoken, never to have it forgotten. One's shadow, the final element, was the solid anchor that kept one in contact with the earth. Ka Ray wanted to accomplish what only one other woman in history had done, become pharaoh of Egypt. Her goal was so unheard of and skillfully carried out that she almost took Egypt by storm. Her goals were simple. If you capture a person's Ba and hold it for your own, power would be yours to control. When the priests of Amun-Ra, the dominant religion of the empire, started to find heartless bodies, they knew that it was Ka Ray and her evil work. In taking one's Ba, Ka Ray turned the victim's blood black. This polluted the body, making it impossible for any earthly return. This terrified the ancient priests. They had no other choice but to destroy her. How she was destroyed had always remained a mystery, lost in the passing of time. This was Parker's obsession, to find her earthly remains and to put to rest a mystery which had haunted him from childhood. Parker joined a work crew who had been concentrating their efforts on a hidden canyon covered by the junk of centuries, an ancient trash heap, purposely placed in the middle of the most sacred burial ground in ancient Egypt. Why?
How are the new diggings working out, Amin?
Parker patted a small Arabic man on the back, removing his hat. The heat was starting to rise in the valley, causing Parker to sweat even more.
Very well, Professor,
Amin explained, directing attention to his crew.
Something is below the threshold. That much is certain.
Parker scratched his head.
What would cause a movement to bury a tomb under a mound of trash? That's a new one for the books.
Perhaps never to be found.
Amin had been a trusted friend and foreman to Parker, almost invaluable in his work. Amin had been on several digs and had proven himself likable to the natives. Half of Parker's success so far was due to Amin's friendship and skill as a leader. A cry was raised in the crew. Steps to a tomb's entrance had been found. Before Parker could run to investigate, Amin stopped him. Clearly, the Arab was worried.
"Sir, I wonder for you,"
Amin said in broken English.
"What do you mean?"
"No permits."
Parker tried to divide his attention between his foreman and his work crew.
"Amin, most of history's finds would have remained forever lost if everyone followed the laws of paperwork."
"Then go."
In contrast to his cautious words, Amin was evidently just as eager to unearth the mysteries ahead of them. There had been questions as to the authenticity of the ancient historical accounts of Ka Ray. Men had been digging in the valley for hundreds of years. Why no discovery? Why no sign of ruins pointing the way? Did this Ka Ray exist at all? Was she just a boogie tale told to keep others in line? For Parker, at least, all doubt was extinguished.
"Professor! Professor!"
Before Parker could reach the first steps of the newly discovered tomb, he turned toward Amin's familiar voice, recognizing concern in the little man's tone. Trouble was on the way.
"Yes, Amin."
Pointing his long fingers toward an oncoming dust cloud, Amin said one word to explain his concerns.
"Sahish!"
If any word had the power to stop the sounds of several shovels, silence the shifting of sand, or the rhythmic breathing of men, it was that name. Sahish was a government official for the French. The man used his power to promote personal gain while hiding behind a uniform. Those who opposed him did not live long.
"Thank you, Amin. Inform the men on the work crews."
In a heartbeat, Amin was among the ranks, warning them to tighten their tongues and to hide all that was dear to them. A second warning was also issued. Those who talked would lose more than their jobs. Disloyal tongues put many of the curiosities rotting in the desert there. Amin hated traitors. As Sahish approached, Parker noticed his carriage. A token of gratitude from the French government, it cost the everyday people much blood.
"I don't need this," Parker moaned,
thinking about the tomb and the discoveries that lay ahead.
"Parker," hissed Sahish.
At first, Parker tried to ignore the intruder under the guise of work. It was a little game they played with each other. Irritated, Sahish stepped out of his carriage so everyone could gaze at his uniform. Parker always noticed how proud Sahish was of his ribbons. Ribbons won for slaughtering innocent people. People whose only crime was hunger. Sahish always took their food, trading it for money to bribe influential men to do his bidding. Sahish covered his tracks well, always telling his superiors that he was gunning down counter-revolutionaries. Parker hated the son of a bitch.
"Parker! You will talk today."
Parker controlled the disgust forming on his face.
"Colonel Sahish, what an honor it is to see you. You do humble us with your presence."
Parker's voice dripped with sarcasm.
"I will talk to you in your tent, now."
"Well, I'm kind of busy. Some of us do have to work for a living."
Sahish spit in the direction of Parker's shoes. To an ordinary man, this would have been an insult, but knowing Sahish the way he did, Parker accepted this man's uncivilized behavior as part of his character.
"As you wish," Parker said, directing the colonel to his tent.
Upon entering the tent, the flaps were closed for privacy. Parker invited Sahish to speak.
"Your permits, Parker."
"Please, colonel."
Parker raised his hand. "You will kindly address me as Professor Parker."
"Very well, Professor Parker."
He spat out Professor as if it were dirt.
"Thank you. Now what is this about my permits?"
"Where are they? I notice you're working independently of the French. Where are your permits?"
Sahish smiled with the secret knowledge of knowing Parker's answer. Parker remained quiet, thinking.
"You are now working with the consent of my good nature, I think."
Sahish laughed between yellowed teeth.
"If you wish to continue, you will help promote my charity. After all, you Americans are known for your charity."
"You know, Colonel, in my country, we have a title for men like you."
"What is this title?"
"Congressman."
Sahish mulled the statement over.
It is an honorable title, no?
Parker paused.
It can be, in the right hands.
No doubt you believe my hands are capable.
No doubt.
Sahish, uninvited, poured himself a cup of Earl Grey tea.
Tea is the only redeeming quality you English have.
I'm not English.
Sahish sipped his tea. He had all day.
That's right. You are American. Billy the Kid. Cowboys and Indians. I'm a great admirer of your country.
Is that so?
Yes. Your military. I've studied the battles of your civil war. Its weapons. You Americans do know the ways of killing. If I had your armies.
Colonel, what is your point?
Parker interrupted. Sahish finished his tea, placed the cup on a nearby table, on which Parker had some artifacts, and let out another of his amused laughs.
You arrogant shit, Parker said to himself. I've put up with your criminal behaviors for more years than I care to ponder on. Why in the hell can't you just come to the point?
I read a book of yours the other night, Parker.
Sahish glared at him with a look of challenge.
It was a brilliant piece.
Thank you. What about my permits?
A fellow scholar approached me in Cairo last week. He was on an imperial dig for the Tsar of Russia.
Parker paused. Was someone else, someone who possessed more political clout, more money, looking for what he had taken so long to labor toward? It didn't matter. He was not going to go home empty-handed. As he had so often heard in his native land, there was more than one way to skin a cat. Dennis Parker would survive.
He wishes to dig, Sahish continued. Here.
Sahish's hand pointed to a spot on a map laid out on the table next to Parker's tea. His curiosity and fear followed the Egyptian's fat finger. The Russians wanted to dig on his site. Impossible. Parker would make a formal protest through the American embassy.
How much?
Parker's patience was wearing out. He still had a good day's work ahead of him.
How much?
Sahish was taken by surprise.
How much money do you want?
Parker looked out beyond his tent. The sun was starting to set. He would have only a couple more hours in which to dig. The colonel stood silent for a moment, studying Parker's features.
No money. I grow tired of you, Parker. I want you out of my country. I will waste no more time with you.
Sahish snapped his fingers, silently ordering a fellow soldier to enter Parker's tent. Upon doing so, the man dropped an official-looking bag on the ground at Parker's feet.
One of my other humble services, Sahish explained. I am here to give you your mail. I have received several letters from a man in Ireland, Thomas Andrews, a friend of yours, perhaps.
Perhaps.
I will leave you then to your reading. I will be back in 3 weeks to help you pack. I have enjoyed our talks.
The colonel paused just outside the tent, giving Parker a hard glare.
I warn you now, Parker. Anything you currently discover belongs to the Egyptian people. Do not test me on this fact, please. We have had our differences, sir, but I will find no satisfaction destroying you.
Sahish smiled, meaning the complete reverse of what he said. Nothing would please the man more than to throw Parker in jail for breaking the law. Sahish left Parker to his problem. 3 weeks. It would take years to investigate his newly discovered tomb. What was he to do?
Sahish knows that I'm close, Parker raged. He wants the discovery for himself.
He started to pace the tent, feeling like a caged animal.
Professor.
Parker jumped, but his shoulders sagged with relief when he recognized Amin.
Yes?
Perhaps there is another way to study your discovery.
Parker was open to any suggestion.
Belfast, Ireland. Harland and Wolfe Shipyard. Lots 400 and 401 and fitting out berth, June 1910. Harland and Wolfe had been praised throughout the known world as the finest shipyard when it came to building the large Atlantic steamers. She towered above the rest. However, something else was starting to dwarf this respected establishment, and it was growing in H&W's own backyard. Ireland had become, once again, the land of giants. Two lots especially created for the task, which formerly was reserved for the construction of three ships, held within them the scientific wonders of the Western world. One near completion in the yard's fitting out berth, the other in the pains of being born. It was a sight to behold. The world had never seen anything like the Olympic-class steamer. Belfast had turned out by the hundreds to witness a sight straight out of Gulliver's Travels. A team of 20 of the strongest horses available strained to help pull one anchor to the yard. This one anchor was the first of six. All who watched actually considered Gulliver and wondered if, during their sleep, they had been transformed into Lilliputians. There was no end to the abilities of man. Like ants, men by the thousands traveled up and down these huge leviathans. Each one had a mission: to build the largest and most luxurious ocean-going vessels the world had ever seen. The heartbeat of the yard was the rhythmic sound of a hammer hitting rivet. The life's blood, however, was iron. Metal ribs reaching up to clasp iron slabs, which created an iron hull. "Mr. Andrews?" The English voice caused Andrews to turn his concentration from the unusual sight in front of him. In all his years working as managing director, he never saw anything more beautiful than the berthing of a new ship. Andrews was a busy fellow, quite professional in his appearance. From a prominent family, he looked the part of an educated man. Often, those who did not know him as a shipbuilder or important government official mistook him as a schoolmaster. He was indeed the kind of man able to handle almost any situation. Andrews thought it best to walk in the yard from time to time to observe the fitting out of his newest ships. The Olympic was his project for the moment, and the first of three giant ships he was building for the White Star Line, a profitable transatlantic company. He had been walking through the incomplete decks of the ship, hoping to see that everything was on schedule. "Mr. Andrews, sir?" the voice repeated.
"Yes, what is it?"
"Engineering needs you to look at these wiring specifications," said a young Englishman, who stood on shaky knees as he addressed his boss. Confused, Andrews thundered over to the nervous young man, dashed the blueprints from his sweaty fingers, and gave them a look. If not perplexed in his study, he would have found great amusement in the terror growing in his employee's eyes. Andrews was known to have a temper.
"Haven't they tested the bloody water evaporators yet?"
Avoiding the question, the young Englishman tried inching away from Andrews. Andrews acknowledged the boy's fear.
"Speak up, man. I don't bite."
"They haven't wired them up as of yet, sir."
"Bloody engineers," Andrews yelled. "We got till October, then we launched this lass. Can't they even install three water evaporators without someone holding their hands?"
Andrews turned around, wanting to give the boy a scolding, and was surprised to see that he was standing in what would later become the ship's first-class library. He walked up nearly three decks, passing seven independent work crews, and almost fell through an incomplete floor, never having noticed or taking his eyes off his blueprints. From across the room, leaving behind a trail of dust, the nervous boy was running away. Andrews, two carpenters, and three men laying carpet were left astonished.
"There's the secret of British rule, gentlemen,"
Andrews joked as he rolled up his blueprints.
"Who can compete with such speed?"
The library filled with laughter. Andrews was confident about one thing. The RMS Olympic had no room on her construction schedule for delays. Andrews had been given specific orders by Lord Peary, owner of Harland and Wolff, that the Olympic had to be ready for launch no later than mid-October. She had to be fitted out and ready for sail so that there would be no problem when they launched her sister ship in May of 1911. Andrews roared down several flights of stairs, stairs that would later be the ship's second-class entrances, until he came to the rough walls of a passageway leading to the reciprocating engine room. Andrews tapped his fingers on the loosely hanging wood barely applied to the bulkheads.
"Like traveling into the belly of a whale," Andrews thought.
He reached the ship's midpoint, traveling down another flight of stairs to the lowest point on the ship. Everywhere he went, Andrews heard at least one "Good morn to you, Mr. Andrews," or "She's a beauty, Tom." Andrews ate it up like candy. He was proud of his ships. Andrews walked past the turbine room, noticing a work team of half a dozen men working hard at installing machinery, sweating and groaning in chorus. Andrews then entered the reciprocating engine room. A slight tingle of satisfaction touched his heart when he heard a workman drop his hammer out of fear. With his men frightened, Andrews knew he could work with them. People think more clearly when they're frightened.
"Mr. Andrews," a workman acknowledged his presence. "Where's the foreman?"
All the workmen pointed to the evaporator room. Andrews headed off in the direction of the room, noticing something wrong with the way the crewmen were working. As managing director, it was his sworn duty to see that the people he was paying actually worked. This he did to a full art. Andrews wasn't ever hard on his men. From time to time, he graded them with his temper, but all that knew him knew that he was a perfectionist and wanted it done his way and his way alone.
"Install that pump now. I want to see it operational by the end of this week."
Andrews ordered two men standing by the evaporator room's entrance.
"Yes, sir,"
one of the men responded, dropping a sandwich he had been eating. Men scurried to the pump room like rats.
"Damn fools," thought Andrews. "What if the ship took on water? How would they expect the captain to get rid of the rising sea? Drink it?"
In the evaporator room, Andrews found several men standing close to three evaporators. Massive machines. Ugly. None of the crewmen looked as if they knew what to do or had the desire to do it with.
"Well," stated Andrews, "am I just in time for the card game?"
"Sorry, Mr. Andrews, we're having a bit of a problem here."
The engineer was a dirty man. Andrews didn't like him, but he respected his knowledge of ships.
"What's wrong?"
"The things won't fit. The evaporators, I mean."
"Make them fit,"
Andrews demanded.
"But, sir..."
"Install them, now, or quit your post," Andrews insisted. "I have no time in my schedule to hold your hand. You're a skilled man, do your job."
"I've never installed anything this big,"
the engineer gawked. Andrews paused, reading the embarrassment clearly on the engineer's face.
"Then I shall explain."
After several minutes of debate, yelling, and later a little diplomacy, Andrew had things up and running. That was, until he looked at the neighboring main condenser.
"God help the British Navy if they drop these bombs."
Andrews started his walk back up the ship, heading toward the sun, his stomach making him pay for his temper.
"One headache after another,"
he mumbled.
"Good God, sometimes I wonder if it is all worth it." "It is indeed a bonny ship. Hell, if I had to do it all over again, I certainly would."
Up on the A-deck promenade, Andrews got a chance to inspect the huge boiler uptake casings as they were being battened down and covered with an enormous gray tarp. Big enough to house a locomotive, these three pits would be topped off by huge funnels, which would allow the ship to have an escape for excess steam and coal smoke. The power of the ship might have been the engines, but the funnels would allow the Olympic to breathe. Andrews knew that without breath, there would be no life. In a rather playful way, after climbing to the roof over the first-class entrance, Andrews wanted to experience the total depth of the abyss. He stood on the edge of the forward boiler uptake, and after finding a piece of wood lying at his feet, he picked it up and innocently tossed it in. Like a child at the bridge, he waited for the wood to hit the bottom. Straining his ears, he couldn't hear the piece of timber make contact.
"Who the hell's throwing things up there?"
The voice echoed with a throb, anger, and tone of a god. It was then that Andrews realized the uptake hadn't reached its final stage of assembly. He couldn't hear the wood hit bottom because there was no lower portion. Andrews cupped his hands over his mouth, shouting down to his unintended victim.
"Sorry, didn't know, man." "Ruddy hell, that's a third time this week. Watch yourself up there, for God's sake."
Andrews would have laughed, but his instinct was interrupted by the sounds of a nearby explosion. He wheeled around, expecting to see flames coming from the Olympic. Quickly, he inspected the ship and found it sound.
"What have they done to my ship?" he wondered.
Andrews was surprised to see nothing wrong.
"So where in the hell is the problem?"
"Sir,"
a young worker shouted. Andrews spotted the nervous Englishman from earlier that day and noticed that he and everyone else was heading in the direction of Lot 401. Whatever the problem, it was not taking place in the fitting out berth.
Bloody hell.
Curiosity taking its toll, Andrews ran to the starboard railings. Below, in the lot across from the Olympic, lay the outline of what was to be another ship. Concrete had been poured into the keel to help reinforce it. Work on laying the keel caused several problems. One incident, a man wrote what could be called nothing more than a blasphemy on one of the iron plates. An iron plate had been laid on the new ship's keel with the number 666 written on it. Andrews later found that it was just the plate's number. Most, however, saw it as ungodly. Andrews could not stop the superstitions men of the sea have and had no other choice but to boot the unfortunate man who numbered the plate out of the yard. Although Andrews wasn't the type to hold a man's mistakes against him, and although it pained him to ruin another person's life, for the good of morale and his company, the task had to be done. Andrews noticed a keen face peering up at him.
"Mr. Andrews, the damn crane's at it again," shouted the workman. "Hell."
Andrews found his way to an exit, leaving the Olympic with the same fire he found when he entered her. Lot 401 was proving herself to be quite a ballbuster, as one of the men working on her later said. For weeks, Andrew had been arguing with the central office to have them fix, or better yet, replace, one of the many cranes that would be used to raise the hull of this new ship. Like most offices, however, Harland and Wolf cared more about bottom lines than the safety of their men.
"Richardson,"
Andrews ordered as he reached the bottom of the huge walk that led to the Olympic,
"go to the central office and bring me Carlisle."
"Right you are, sir."
Richardson, one of the many faces in the workforce, hightailed his way to the end of the gantry and headed for the central office. Andrews walked over to where a crowd of people stood.
"All right, what's going on?"
he asked harshly. Andrews broke up a ring of people who seemed to be encircling something that was just beyond his sight. The shipbuilder's heart skipped a beat upon opening the wall of workmen.
"Dear God,"
Andrews prayed, crossing himself. Buried under a huge slab of iron weighing at least a half ton was what had been a man. A hand reached out from the iron, twitching, reaching for the sky. All were silent as they watched what blood that had managed to escape form a river and head toward the new keel. The Red River hit the keel and mingled with the ship, bonding into one.
"Somebody call a doctor, for the love of God," Andrew shouted.
"No doctor can help him, mate," an Australian worker said sullenly. "He's done for, he is."
Andrews took off his jacket and without thinking covered up the unfortunate man's twitching hand.
"Curse this ship,"
a workman huffed. Andrews turned toward his men, giving them a glare.
"Who said that?"
The men, like guilty children, started to slowly step back, saying nothing.
"Death on a ship is bad luck, Mr. Andrews. What with that writing on her and everything?"
Andrews eyed the worker. What could he say? One could not argue against death when one was staring it in the face.
"All right," Andrews replied. "Let's all get back to work, shall we?"
One by one, the men left. None noticed the tears forming in their managing director's eyes.
"You wanted to see me, Tom," a voice said from behind.
Andrews wiped his eyes, turning to see the face of Alexander Carlisle gleaming at him. Carlisle took in the dire tableau before him. The man's appearance suddenly changed.
"What happened here?"
he asked, horrified.
"The crane," Andrews explained. "She failed us again."
He stood solemn, continuing.
"This time the bloody thing killed a man."
Carlisle stood motionless. Although he knew of cranes, and although he was the chief designer of all the davits that went on each H&W ship, his mind was as empty at the sight as Andrew's.
"What can I do?"
he asked.
"Go with me to the board," Andrews insisted. "Tell them we need better equipment. You've been here longer than I have. They'll listen if it's the two of us."
"Listen, will they?" Carlisle gave out a dry laugh. "They've already refused to hear me when it comes to these tubs you are building."
"What is that supposed to mean?"
"These damn brutes need more lifeboats." Andrews laughed.
"What's so damn funny?" "The ship itself is a lifeboat. She's unsinkable."
"Thomas, if she floats, she sure as hell can sink,"
no matter how bloody big she is.
The men stopped arguing as the iron slab before them was raised. The remains of what was a man were brought into the sunlight. All hammering stopped, all welding ceased, and all eyes fell on the small red dot that had been their fellow workman.
"Get used to that sight," Carlyle warned. "If anything, you need to get the board to listen to my requests. Or one of these days, the ocean will be floating with men such as this one."
Carlyle paused.
"It will be your fault."
Andrews, upon hearing this, went into a frenzy. He was many things, but he never considered himself a murderer. He wasn't going to stand around and hear a fellow worker accusing him of such. Before he knew what had come over him, Andrews punched Carlyle in the mouth, knocking him down. Overcome by the moment, Andrews was flooded by a wall of cheering from his workforce. All were praising him, believing him the savior of their problems. Little did they know that he was only defending his ego. Andrews left the lot. One of the most fantastic sights was quitting time. 1,500 workers, all wishing to return to their wives, their loved ones, or happy children, who looked up at them with innocent eyes, believing them to be the center of the universe. Although work was hell, it sustained all of this. Andrews had plans to go home, but the men, applauding what he had done earlier to Carlyle, invited him to a local pub so that they all could toast the friend they had lost that day. What could Andrews do? Tired, he had no other choice in the matter.
"To Walter," the pub owner cried. "A good man who left Ireland 3 fine sons. May they all grow to be like their father."
All drank heartily. On sad events such as these, the pub served one round on the house.
"Gentlemen," addressed the pub owner, "I give you Mr. Thomas Andrews."
Andrews practically had to force himself to drink his dark beer. The foam from the beverage stuck to the walls of his throat, causing him to choke.
"A toast to our ship, my lads."
Everyone in the pub stood solemnly.
"Although she be quite a bitch to us, and as of yet never treated us with kindness, I give a toast to the RMS Titanic. Long may she serve."
The pub filled with the sound of clanking glasses.
"To the Titanic,"
Andrews toasted as he finished his beer. Caught up in the excitement of the moment, the men, breaking down their barriers, sang like angels. While Andrews became quite drunk, he was still unable to erase the tragedies of the day from his mind. Andrews fought back the men who were keeping him in his chair, thinking he ought to hail a hansom and try to make it home before his wife scolded him beyond an inch of his life. A man might be the king of his castle, but as all married men learn, it is the queen who actually wears the crown. Chapter 2. April 2nd, 1912. RMS Titanic, Belfast, Ireland, 6 o'clock a.m. What an incredible sight she was. In the entire world, there was nothing like the unsinkable Titanic. So unique was her status in the world that men compared her to Stonehenge, yet another milestone in the edifice of human engineering. The British, upon looking at their little boat, had a lot to be proud of. In Ireland's eyes, she was Irish. Irish brain fused her, Irish heart made her, and Irish blood had been spilled for her. Like a proud swan, she left her nest as the cries of the ordinary men who built her cheered her as she went on her way. Never again would she be a thing belonging to the little people. She was now the play toy to the wealthy and powerful. With the bridge standing over 100 feet out of the water, she could put her stance against any American skyscraper. Any ship she came into contact with, she instantly dwarfed. She was 882 feet, 9 inches long, 94 feet wide, and had a cost over 1,500,000 British pounds, or approximately 7,500,000 American dollars. Although the Titanic and her sister ship, the Olympic, were identical in dimensions, more staterooms and suites were added to the Titanic, making her the heavier of the two. The Titanic had become the largest ship in the world. After all the planning, it was time to put her to test. Over 100,000 people came out to see her launch. Sea trials had been delayed 24 hours due to high winds. Calm seas now awaited her. All was perfect. Tugs, pulling the Titanic through Victoria Channel, strained with all their horsepower as they managed to bring their lovely passenger out into the Belfast lock. The massive ocean liner was not under power. She was too big for the channel. Deep inside her hull, stokers, the men who shoveled chunks of coal into her boilers, sweated lakes of salt water, doing what they could so that the captain on the bridge could give the word and start the engines. Innocent passers-by on the shore couldn't help but join in the celebration, admiring the huge black billows of smoke coming from the first three of the ship's four large gold and black funnels. All people, as if aware of something special, held their breath as the Titanic crept out to sea. A brass band shipped in from London by the White Star Line, the owners of the Titanic, played, fighting with the cheers. "Rule Britannia. Britannia rules the waves." With a blast of foam, the Titanic started to turn her three large screws. 7:30 a.m. E-deck, near first-class staterooms. Andrews studied his blueprints, minding his own business. Nobody really paid that much attention to the rather tall gentleman as he silently walked through the long hall. Andrews felt a little guilty about the Titanic's fitting out, thinking it best to travel on board. The construction, launch, and maiden voyage of the Titanic's sister ship had taken its toll on his health. Exhausted, Andrews placed most of the burdens of construction on those below him, and of course Bruce Ismay of the White Star Line. Ultimately, it was Ismay, according to the original contract with the White Star Line, who had the last word on design, equipment, and decoration. Andrews had only wanted to come on board to iron out the rough spots. He decided to stay only after hearing that his boss, who wanted to travel with the ship on its maiden voyage, had become too ill to attend. Andrews spotted something curious out of the corner of his eye. Something that was dreadfully wrong.
"What the bloody hell is this?" he exclaimed, livid.
Andrews unrolled the bolt of blueprints he had in his hands. There were not enough lights in the hallway, he discovered. This was strange, since he designed every aspect of the ship. He had been silently counting the fixtures and was pretty confident about the fact that he hadn't overlooked any of the outlets.
"This is peculiar,"
he said out loud, never taking his eyes off his blueprints. A chambermaid, giving Andrews a curious stare, rushed past him to giggle with a fellow worker as they continued their chores to ready the ship. Andrews gave them a polite nod as they disappeared around a corner. 12:45 p.m. Bridge.
"Captain on the bridge."
Captain Bartlett entered the bridge of the Titanic with an air of awe that he rarely experienced during his long career in seamanship. It had taken several hours getting used to the immense size and complexity of this new vessel. Quite sooner than he wished, he would be stepping down from this command, giving it to another. In later years, he could honestly say that he was the first captain on her. Bartlett, like most captains, appeared to be in a miserable mood. He caught a glimpse of the officer standing in the ship's wheelhouse inspecting the watertight door control panel.
"Mr. Lightoller," he barked.
Lightoller, hearing the voice of his commanding officer, placed his inspection board into the hands of a fellow crewman.
"Sir, kindly step out onto the bridge, please."
The bridge, basically just an open room in front of the wheelhouse, was big enough to have doubled as a promenade deck. The only signs that the open deck had any kind of conventional design were the four ship's telegraphs, compass, ship's communicator, and auxiliary telemotor, ship's wheel, which were spread across the deck. The telemotor on the bridge would rarely be used, only for dire emergencies. Most of the navigation would be handled in the wheelhouse where the primary navigational controls were stationed. If needed, however, the bridge's wheel was connected with those of the wheelhouse and docking bridge, which was at the other end of the ship. The Titanic was a fantastic navigational machine.
"You called, sir?"
"Yes, Mr. Lightoller."
Bartlett was busy scanning the horizon with his set of binoculars.
"Why don't we give this ship a proper shakedown?"
The captain studied Lightoller. The officer was a young man, too young for his years.
In his countenance, the captain noticed the kind of idealistic gleam one hoped to find in the eyes of a handsome suitor coming to call on his daughter. Blonde hair, clean-shaven, and every bit the merchant officer England was famous for. Bartlett, lowering his glasses, winked at this officer, trying desperately to hold back his excitement.
Isa, Lightoller confirmed.
Ahead half speed, Bartlett ordered.
Ahead half speed, aye.
With a dart of energy, the massive ocean liner left her tugboats far behind. Later, captains of those tugs would talk with amazement. They would say that they never saw anything that big move so quickly.
Hard to port, Bartlett shouted. Hard to port, aye.
In the wheelhouse, the telemotor was turned to the left. With the grace of a ballerina, the Titanic sliced through the waters of the Irish Sea. With an almost godlike authority, the ship passed every conceivable order given to it by her temporary captain. Various turnings, several stop-start maneuvers, full reverse, and full ahead at 20 knots. She performed well above expectations.
I'm rather jealous of Smith, Master Lightoller.
Quite impressive, Lightoller agreed.
Nothing less for the Commodore of the Line, wouldn't you say, Lightoller?
Bartlett entered the wheelhouse, feeling a bit taller.
How far have we sailed, Quartermaster?
Bartlett asked upon studying the ship's controls.
About 40 miles, sir.
Speed?
18 knots.
Turn us about,
Bartlett ordered.
We're going home.
The Titanic passed her trials. She was ready for the transatlantic trade. Her trials lasted less than 1 day. Chapter 3. Harland and Wolff Shipyards, Titanic. Final inspection, 3:37 p.m. Andrews didn't have much time. If he was to accompany his ship on her maiden voyage, he had only 4 hours to get his affairs in order, say farewell to his wife and daughter, and successfully pack. The Titanic was scheduled to leave for Southampton, England, by 8 that evening. Everything was moving at a dizzying pace. Although the streets were foggy, it did not hinder Andrew's awareness. About a mile from the dock, he knew that he was being followed. His breath grew shallow as he listened. The footfalls were not that of an ordinary man. Andrews could clearly hear the sharp fall of one foot. However, the second seemed to drag and had an artificial sound to it. It sounded wooden, dead.
All right, Thomas, don't panic, he told himself. It could simply be a match girl or some other poor soul following you in hopes of obtaining a crown or two.
The street started to close in on the shipbuilder. A fog began to cause Andrews to see things that he had only imagined during childhood, demons that were best left in the closet. People walking home seemed to take on different forms. No longer appearing human, they became the banshees of legend, searching the land for souls to devour. Every sound seemed to be magnified. Every second was an eternity. Every heartbeat, a silent explosion. Andrews, wanting to know the identity of his follower, slowed his pace. His hand, drenching with nervous sweat, tightened around the wooden case in which he carried his blueprints. The size and weight would make an excellent weapon.
God, let it just be an overactive imagination, he prayed.
Behind a wall of fog, only inches from Andrews, the intruder stopped his pursuit. Andrews strained to see through the darkness. His hand tightened on the case. Unconsciously, he raised it, ready to swing at whatever was hiding in the night. From out of the fog came a tiny figure dressed in what appeared to be a monk's cloak.
"Please don't beat me, kind Englishman, sir,"
the hunched-over man pleaded with Andrews, hobbling pathetically toward him. Andrews was set aback. In all his life, he had never seen such a miserable creature as the one cowering in front of him. The poor soul was actually trying to kiss Andrew's shoes. In disgust, Andrews started kicking the figure away.
"Get the hell away from me," Andrews demanded.
"Please, kind Englishman," the man pleaded. "You must hear my master out."
The hooded figure pointed toward the other end of the street.
"What?"
Andrews stammered, looking toward the direction the man was pointing.
"You are Thomas Andrews?" the man asked.
Andrews looked back at him. How did this horrible creature know his name?
Yes.
Andrews continued to hold up his case.
How do you know me?
Thomas Andrews, the shipbuilder.
Andrews was shocked.
How do you know all this?
The man came to life, uncovering his head. Andrews could now see that he had been talking to an Arab. This little man, who had on his facial features the burdens of a rough life, grabbed Andrews by the shoulders and pulled him into a nearby alley.
"Do not frighten Englishman," the Arab said, seeming to sense Andrews' horror. "I seek to do you no harm."
Andrews looked down. A wooden leg stuck out of his assailant's knee where there should have been a foot. Other scars blemished the man's brown skin. One traveled down the right side of his face, ending at what appeared to be an old rope burn around his neck. A lame left hand, missing two fingers, patted Andrews on the shoulder as if trying to comfort him.
"What do you want with me?"
Andrews asked, anger mingling with his fear. When the man didn't answer, Andrews began to wonder if his assailant was waiting for others to come. Help steal his money. It was time to take action. Andrews attacked. The Arab, taken entirely by surprise, found himself flying across the alley and ricocheting off a brick wall. Andrews noticed that he must have broken the man's nose. Blood was trickling down the haggard face. The Arab had little chance to cry out. Andrews crossed the few feet separating them and struck his assailant. It felt good. Andrews continued to pound the man's face. With each impact of his fists, blood sprayed from Andrews' attacker, hitting the shipbuilder in the face and impairing his vision. Andrews blinked the hot blood out of his eyes. The horror and thrill of the moment was pressing him on.
"Please, please," the Arab shouted. "I mean you no harm. No harm."
His voice was laced with pain and fear. Andrews towered over the helpless form of his would-be attacker. Grabbing the man's rags, Andrews pulled him up.
"Why were you following me?" Andrews demanded. "Speak up, man, before I crush you."
The Arab looked past Andrews, focusing his eyes on the other end of the alley. Hope erased fear on the Arab's face, causing Andrews to drop the man and glance toward the open street. Andrews saw a dark shadow swaying amongst the alley's debris. The two men were not alone.
"Please, master!" the Arab shouted, pointing up the street. "This English is a crazy man."
Preparing for another attacker, Andrews loosened his tie and waited for a fight. The Arab behind him cowered like a frightened child.
"Step on out, you bloody coward," Andrews challenged. "Or did your mother raise you to hide from those you assault?"
A dark shape could be seen moving at the mouth of the alley. The shadow's quick reflexes startled Andrews as it seemed to scurry from the moonlight.
"Well then," Andrews said, "come on and be done with it."
Like the banshee in Andrews' fears, the ominous shadow started to move toward him. Its frame was impressive.
"Listen to the master," the Arab said behind him. "He is a friend. He has a funny way of showing it."
Andrews' fear turned to confusion as Dennis Parker came out of the shadows. His clenched fists fell to his sides. His mouth dropped open, looking almost comical.
"Dennis, can it be you?"
Parker's blue eyes glistened with amusement at Andrews.
"I'm sorry that we scared you, Thomas. I had to make sure you were alone."
The men jumped as a series of gunshots echoed down the alley. Andrews slammed himself against the brick wall and quickly tried to decipher their direction. Chunks of brick next to his arm turned into dust as another shot went off. Amin, now disposing of his cloak, grabbed Andrews and pulled him to the ground. Parker, crawling on his belly, went to his friend's assistance, his face clearly showing more understanding than Andrew's.
"What the hell is going on here?" Andrews shouted.
"Son of a bitch," Parker cursed, directing his gaze to Amin.
"How did he know?"
"The man has 1,000 eyes, Professor," Amin replied.
"Dennis, who the hell's shooting at us?"
Andrews yelled.
"No time to explain."
"Bloody hell, Dennis," Andrews hissed through clenched teeth.
"What's going on here?"
"We need to hide," Parker replied. "Know a good place close by?" Before Andrew could respond, several more shots rang out. Some came too close.
"Tell me what's going on here and I'll consider it." Andrews paused. "Are you wanted by the law?"
Another series of bullets hit the wall behind them. Loud voices filled the air. It sounded as if there were 100 men all shouting in Arabic outside the alleyway.
"Thomas, for the love of God," Parker said. "We must get out of here. I'm not moving until you tell me what's going on. If we don't leave, they'll kill us."
Andrews steadied his friend. Andrews darted up, grabbing Parker and Amin by the hands.
"I have a flat nearby. I use it when I fit out a ship."
4 o'clock p.m., 2 miles from shipyards. General Sahish sat in his carriage, glaring at the trembling soldier before him. For 3 months, the soldier had been chasing the infidel American, and for 3 months, he had to tell his superiors that he was failing. From Egypt to Prussia, from Prussia to Russia, from Russia to Scotland, and from Scotland to Ireland. All encounters with the American were failures.
"With all the guns we have at our disposal, you couldn't kill 2 men,
Sahish raged. His lips started trembling with frustration.
3, said the soldier meekly. "He was seen with another."
Sahish's frame straightened with concern. Perhaps Parker had an ally in this land as he had in the others? The American was a man of the world. He had to have worldly friends.
"Where did they run?"
Sahish grabbed the man by the throat, his eyes burning with anger.
"Tell me now, or I shall kill you where you stand. We will return with what the American has stolen."
With his face turning purple from the strangling, the soldier produced a small business card. Sahish's eyes turned from his prey to that of what was in his victim's hand. As quickly as he attacked, the newly promoted general let go.
"What's this?"
"The third man dropped it," the soldier said, rubbing his throat.
"I will not allow this Parker or the scum who have helped him take my rank away from me. I have killed too many to get it."
The general looked at the small card, studying its little writing.
"The egos of these Western men. To think that they are so special that they must announce themselves with a ridiculous card. The fools."
Sahish read the printing. Thomas Andrews, Harland and Wolff Shipyards, Belfast, Managing Director.
"Andrews," Sahish mulled with remembrance. "The letters I delivered. Parker received mail from this man."
Sahish's people stood to wait. Their leader was sincere in his evil plans.
"This is the end of the chase,"
Sahish proclaimed, crumbling Andrew's card in his hand.
"I know where the American is going. I know whom he is getting to help him. Parker will never leave Ireland alive."
Sahish laughed. 4:45 p.m. Thomas Andrews' apartment. Thomas Andrews quietly opened his front door and was relieved to discover that his family had gone out. If Parker was in danger, he did not want to involve his family. Andrews' living quarters was that of any good Irishman's. Although more elaborate due to his important office, he preferred things on a more traditional taste. His wife considered his simplicity amusing, especially since his job was to build floating palaces for the wealthy. Andrews could have lived like a king if he wanted to, but he never had a desire to flaunt his wealth. Andrews invited Parker in, discovering that Amin would not enter.
"Please," Andrews insisted. "If you are a friend of this man, you're welcome in my house."
Amin raised his hands in protest. Andrews could see that the man wished only to guard the front door.
1,000 blessings on your soul, kind sir, but it is not my place."
Amin lowered himself to the ground, sitting. If trouble were to knock at Andrews' door, it would first have to pass this man. Entering the parlor, Andrews offered Parker a chair. Sitting next to him, Andrews said,
"Now would you mind telling me what the hell's going on?"
Staring at his hands, Parker said nothing. Andrews studied his friend, wondering what had happened to the Parker of years past. Parker had always been a determined man, a man of distinct action. This man, however, looked to be cautious, uncertain of what to do. Parker rose and looked out the window of Andrews' parlor. The street was quiet, almost frightening.
"Dennis," Andrews said with concern, "tell me what's wrong. Sit down. Tell me what has caused you to act in such a manner."
When Parker still didn't reply, Andrews glanced at his watch and said,
"I have to leave. I'm sailing on a ship in less than 2.5 hours. "Yes, I know." "You do?"
Parker took a paper from his waistcoat and handed it to his friend. The front page was filled with information about the Titanic. Andrews read the first paragraph and looked at his friend.
I'm glad to see that my career is of interest to you. I still say that you could have been one hell of a shipbuilder if you had at least tried to apply yourself.
Parker coughed.
Never had the aptitude. Your math was as good as mine, Andrews challenged. If you remember correctly, you and I were the only two to make it when things got kind of sticky and close.